Joe, how's it going?
Great. Everything's fine. Welcome to another ordinary week where everything's exactly ordinary and just like it always is, except it's not. Because there's an episode that's here that's been recorded, and it's about the Matrix, and mm-hmm. it's about a world where it's not really the world. It is the world that the lie that surrounds you. That you're better than this world, and you're a super special, ultra wonderful human being, and you are too good for all of this other stuff around you, and you're the only one who can see things for the way they really are, and you'll fix the whole world all by yourself because you're the one.
I feel like you're trying to draw some parallels here.
No, I will say that on the surface, it does seem like the main star of the Matrix is someone that a lot of Redditors cast themselves as. there are a lot of people on the internet who feel like they are Neo, and that they
something
just,
has come up and there is none but me that can intercede.
Yeah, and that they have they haven't found their Trinity yet. But they're the Neo, and they see the things for the way they really are. And they'll
keep wearing those leather trench coats and leather fedoras or whatever, and you'll find her.
Yeah, no, but that's not really the way things are. I don't think these people realize that they are in fact Cypher, and that they are the MRA super creep. Who
is definitely not Cypher is Micah, because Cypher has a really big, delicious looking steak in this movie.
That is very true. There is a steak scene. Which
you say steak scene like it's like a sex scene or something, but with a steak.
It's a very sexy steak. I mean, he's chewing on it. You know, he's talking about, you know, how tasty it is, and you mm-hmm. know, ignorance.
At least he was
is
smart
bliss.
Enough to pair it with a nice red wine too. Although I don't know. I mean, I feel like the cigar would sort of overpower the flavor of the steak. So maybe that was a poor choice.
I also feel like there isn't a restaurant in the world that would let you smoke a cigar. But
not anymore.
Yeah. But not in 1999 either.
Maybe in France or something. Can you believe this movie is from 1999?
I can. Did you know?
That's so long ago.
It's been longer since The Matrix than since I was born, because I saw this when I was like 17 or 16 or 17. So it's been 18 years of The Matrix being in existence, which is bananas to think about. Big movie.
I was 15. Ew.
Yeah.
My God. I was very stupid.
Why do you say that? Did you run out and buy some of those Black Maui gyms?
No. I just mean in general, I was stupid when I was 15.
Okay, well, I
had nothing to do with the movie. I was just, you know, dumb.
Yeah, I mean, we have recorded evidence of that. But
1999, I feel like this movie holds up pretty well for 1999. What do you think?
Here's what I'll say. I feel like the movie dramatically holds up well. I feel like there is styling and trappings and the execution of things that does not hold up as well. And not just because things in the film haven't aged as well, but because there have been so many imitators, not specifically of this film, but of things about this film, who put it into their own action movies, that if you were someone, let's say a millennial, who had not seen this original source material, and you had just been exposed to the films as they were coming out in your age group, and then you were to go back and watch The Matrix, you wouldn't be like, oh, wow, or anything, because you would have seen things that are along these lines, things with, quite frankly, more effects and more fighting and more stuff. This is really something that was a change of pace in action films when it was released. But it certainly, I would say, is not even the most outlandish of the action films that have come after it. Even including the two Matrix movie sequels, which came after this one. So there's stuff about it that I don't know if someone who might be 18 right now going back and watching this, would be like, oh, wow, it's so amazing. Because it's just, it's very 1999 in a lot of ways. But that doesn't mean that I don't see value in it, if that makes any sense. And it doesn't mean that I'm not drawn in by the silly story, which I still quite like.
It was a very judicious answer, I must say.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just trying to be specific because I like the movie, and I don't feel like it's boring or it has like weird slow parts that can cause a problem. Like a lot of the 70s movies that we talk about or 80s movies that we talk about, where the pacing can be extremely uneven. I don't have those sorts of quibbles about this, but there's stuff about the execution of the film, which quite frankly could have been polished a little better. They do things that hadn't been done in cinema before, but some of them just aren't holding up. Like that when he gets covered in all the chromey stuff, doesn't look like chrome. The little thing that goes in his belly button doesn't look real at all. The bending and flexing of various things with a normal distortion, not.
You mean the hallway?
Yeah, the hallway, the side of the building, when they go inside of other people, when the agents are transforming from one person to another person. Like, none of this is the kind of effects work that you would think of as groundbreaking these days. It's the kind of things, it's the kind of stuff you would see on like a TNT like movie.
I think some of it was done stylistically. They knew the limitation and they chose to do it a certain way.
No, okay. I know stylistically, but like just in terms of the technical stuff, there are flaws with it. Like the chrome stuff that crawls all over him doesn't.
It's a mirror. It's not chrome necessarily.
It doesn't reflect. It's not reflecting the way that it should be reflecting.
well, there's a lot of fake reflections in this movie, the least of which weird is Morpheus's glasses.
Yeah, and so there's that stuff which can be somewhat distracting. But it doesn't break the movie for me, because I can look past it. There's very little of it, astonishingly, because this did not have anywhere close to the kind of budget that you might think of. This was a $63 million film when it was made in 1989, which is a little bit higher than middle of the road. And it was filmed in the US and Australia. This is not the kind of blockbuster that you see these days, where things are typically going north of $100 million. This is nothing like that at all. And there's a lot of stuff in here where it's wire work, that is very obviously wire work. But because you're inside of a world which isn't supposed to be real, it doesn't bother me as much, that it's not, as physically accurate. As if they were trying to depict this as like the real world that they went into from a computer simulation, and they were trying to behave in ways that the real world couldn't perform in.
Although some of these things, like, you know, the jumps from building to building, like we wouldn't have any really real perspective on what that would look like in the real world because people can't do that. So, I mean, we would be trying to reference something in our mind that we don't have a reference for.
Yeah. But like when he jumps up in the air and like air kicks, Smith in the chest, and like, you know, they're like basically levitating off of walls as they're running down them. Mm-hmm. Like, it's all wire work, and you can tell it's wire work, but that doesn't make it bad.
It's a world with rules that he doesn't have to abide, Joe, because he's the one.
Anyway, I'm trying to just be very specific about this. I'm just saying that it's good, and I don't mind the shortcomings that it has, but it definitely does have them. And I feel like perhaps it's a good thing that it was only $63 million. I don't feel like this movie needed a penny more.
Do you think they would have had a George Lucas situation where they would have run off and done a bunch of garish, horrible things if they had all the money and time in the world?
Exhibit A, Matrix Reloaded. Exhibit B, Matrix Revolutions.
Well, okay, sure, yes. But don't you think some of that is because there was massive expectation and they had to follow up this movie with something even bigger spectacle-wise? Like, if this is the first in the series and they just had the resources they wanted, don't you think it would have been better than Reloaded and Revolutions? I'll take your silence as a no.
I mean, I don't understand. That's an impossible thing to predict, because why would they have just like buckets of money for this?
No, I'm not saying they would, but yeah. I'm just saying I don't know that they would have squandered or used additional money on the first movie poorly, given that they wouldn't have had the expectations of a sequel.
Okay, well, there's literally no way to debate this conversation.
That's true, but it doesn't stop us from saying having stupid debates all
okay.
the time.
I will say this is one of the noteworthy things about The Matrix is that it bears a similarity to many of their films that came before it, and some of which were bombs, like Dark City, Alex Proyas' film.
Is that the one with the floating people with the long arms and stuff?
Bald heads, and it was the floating city that went upside down.
I don't think I ever saw that, but I saw trailers.
It's interesting. A lot of people who consider themselves to be very serious about film prefer it to The Matrix. I'm not that serious. But there's other things in here that harken back to elements of things from like Cronenberg or Carpenter or the Hong Kong action movies, or this is very much a postmodern film where they've assembled things that they like into a film. Not the least of which would be William Gibson's work, Neuromancer, etc.
Which is interesting though, because in a very Tarantino kind of way, like yeah, they assembled elements from a lot of the movies of the past that they were interested in, but they did it in such a way that it became its own thing and became the iconic movie that other movies would parody for decades to come after that.
Yeah, because, for example, the star of this film, Keanu Reeves, was in a film based on a William Gibson novella or short story or whatever. Anyway, it's called Johnny Mnemonic, and it is so unbelievably bad. You would not you just couldn't fathom how awful that movie is. And you wouldn't believe that it came out in, I think it was 95. It was just basically 4 years before this movie. And it just seems like a completely different world that would have led to its production. Yeah, 95. So it's
like that where you always see a movie and you're like, wow, these effects are really bad. Then you'd like realize that it came out the same year as Jurassic Park. You're like, oh no, these were just bad filmmakers.
Yeah, no, but there was technology that had improved over those years, but at the same time, they were incapable of constructing a story or acting or anything that would have compensated for that. Meanwhile, I feel like The Matrix, without having all of the extra visual trappings, has a lot going for it in terms of the characters and the dialogue and the actors and the way they work together and the chemistry that they have. Which is a weird thing to say, because most of the time they're being very detached and aloof. But you still get a sense that there is a connection between Carrie Ann Moss and Neo. And you still get a sense that, Morpheus, played by Lawrence Fishburne, has a reverence for Neo and for, the resistance and what it means. You get that coming through in their acting and in their sparse dialogue. And of course, Agent Smith, Hugo Weaving, his monologuing and his ridiculous, drawn out Mr. Anderson way of talking about things. Like it's iconic for this particular production, and it all works together, so you could watch this movie without the effects and it would still be good, whereas there aren't a lot of modern day blockbusters you could watch without the effects, because you'd be missing almost all of the movie. and I feel like that's one of the more interesting differences between this and some of the modern action fare that you see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of those things that, aside from being parodied into oblivion, the other Matrix movies, just because, you know, it sort of exists as like a singular story that is told over three movies. But given that there's two-thirds of material that is like post-awakening for Neo, it kind of buries a lot of that like real-world awakening. You know, there's a lot of metaphor junk in the beginning there, but like you really forget that you know, one of the things that struck me about watching this time is that the people in this movie, they're not just like randos, they're computer hackers. Like the whole subgenre, like secret computer hackers of the underworld kind of thing. Like, I forget about that until I watch this again tonight. And it's like, yeah, why are they all computer hackers that then go on to be kung fu fighters and saviors of the world? Like, so everyone at Zion was just like one of these like awesome computer hackers in this, in their fun little, I don't know, dark web world or something, and then they were awakened because they need to have like soft skills to like program in the Matrix in addition to like learn how to fight and stuff when they're in the Matrix and things. It's one of those things that obviously they have to do a lot of world building, this being the first movie, but this first one feels very different than like the idea of the Matrix movies in my head. Did you feel that at all, or did you remember all along that these are just like computer nerds theoretically?
Well, I remember that they are theoretically computer nerds that were all sort of grouped together. We don't get the origin story for each of the members of this team coming together. We only get it for Neo, and we just interpret that the rest of them are hackers, except for the couple that are who were born naturally without having been raised inside of the battery farm thing, which is a ridiculous conceit of this story.
The battery farm?
Yeah.
Everyone points out that the battery farm is, like, absurd and could never, like, happen, but I did want to point out something that I don't think I had heard previously, is that the voiceover in this movie says, in conjunction with a type of fusion they discovered, so it's not entirely powered on human batteries.
Yeah, but it still isn't... If you were a machine, this wouldn't make any sense, really.
Well, if the humans scorched the sun and you didn't have solar power.
Yeah, but that would just be out of spite, because this is not efficient.
Well, maybe they have...
Yeah, no, whatever. No, it just doesn't matter. But there are many things in this movie that you just have to take with a grain of salt and just keep moving. Not the least of which is the fact that it's the year 1999, and they found that this is the best way to keep people happy, is to keep them in this sort of state, and then it raises questions like, how would one do that? How do you just start the world in 1999? How do you keep the world in 1999? Well, unfortunately, we would get answers to these, and they're bad, and that comes later. But...
Oh, there's answers as to why everything is perpetually stuck in 1999? I don't remember that.
Spoiler alert. But in the follow-up sequel, basically they talk about how they go through a process with this. A very deliberate
process.
There's
like the cycle of years or whatever.
That's how you...
Oh, I didn't think that applied to the people of the Matrix on the whole. But I guess that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, you just got to keep doing it. Got to flush them all out, start over again, new batch. But
I guess I would buy into the idea that an active, engaged brain would create more energy from a body than a comatose body. But it's still a lot of infrastructure for their body farming. Although I guess if you're, you know, the global superpower AI thing, you could whip up the programs overnight, because that's what you do.
Just have vats of bacteria or something, or just, I don't know, farm dogs or something. Like, it doesn't make any sense why you would do this, because unless it was specifically about spite and some sort of weird relationship with humanity, That's beside the point. There are other things.
Well, it's like how humans domesticated dogs and cats, right? So the computers are domesticating us and using us for power.
Yeah, just like how we use our dogs. We just plug our pugs into Instagram, and then it's a power source that fuels Mark Zuckerberg.
In conjunction with mops and brooms, we have domesticated dogs to help keep our floors clean. So it's not the primary method by how we keep our floors clean, but they do help keep our floors clean. When we drop some food, they'll eat it. So we as humans in the Matrix may not be the primary source of energy for the machines, but we are a source of energy, and we are also a threat, because if we wake up, we could blow up their computer thingy.
Yeah. So it's a really delicate thread there. But so the...
I buy it.
The other thing you have to take with a grain of salt is the Oracle, who is not explained very thoroughly, but she is very knowledgeable, as demonstrated in the film. And acted superbly, I must say. I quite like the casting choice for her. She's not an actress I was familiar with. And unfortunately, she's only in the next movie and it's Gloria Foster. She died before the third one. So she was recast as another actress. But
I'm not sure I remembered that. That's a bummer.
Yeah. But she's good. And she gives an interesting take on this very knowledgeable person, this Yoda, who knows just the right things to say to motivate and push the buttons to make things happen, and to make the world work. But at the same time, not entirely concerned with some of the ramifications of not telling people certain things. And of course, from maybe withholding things or not knowing other things. Like, she can be oddly specific about how Neo needs to interact with Morpheus, but at the same time she could be like, oh yeah, so you guys are gonna go out of here and there's gonna be a trap, and then these people will die, because either that doesn't matter, or she knows that's necessary in order for him to do his thing, or she can't see that, she can only see the big things or whatever, but then raises other questions. So there are mechanics to how she can predict the future that don't make sense either, so you have to take them with a grain of salt. And she has some really interesting lines, like when she says, don't worry about the vase, and he knocks over the vase, and then she says, you know, don't worry about it. And then she says, what's really going to bake your noodle later is when you wonder whether or not you would have broken the vase if I hadn't said anything, which is an interesting little, you know, predestination kind of paradox thing. It's like, is it fate that I broke that, or what, did you say it and it made me break it, or like how would that have gone down? So she's interesting and she raises some interesting questions, but it's never clear the mechanics of how she functions in this computer world, because it's not magic, but whatever. And there are some other peculiar things, like they have hover ships that fly through sewer pipes and stuff, and then they can just dial in from wherever they are to broadcast to the Matrix. And then the Matrix is just like, incoming, you know, ring from IP, whatever, totally let it through. Like, don't they have a secure wireless network? Like, what are they?
They're hacking in. They're hackers, though.
No, but that's... that's not how hacking works. But, And they have other weird things, like they need the hard lines as a mechanic for how they need to get back to the real world, which is like, but they're not really hard lines. They're just things inside of the computer program, which sort of symbolize an exit for you. But at the same time, how does the mechanic of that work? And like when they call in, they just sort of materialize and the camera spins around the phone while it's ringing.
Yeah, they never really explain the whole materializing in the world, but I buy all of the other things as not really needing explanation, but they are peculiarities. I'm sure we could come up with rationalizations for all of them, just like the filmmakers probably did too.
Yeah, no, and I don't need them. I want to stress that too. There are a lot of things in this that are peculiar and raise questions, and they don't get answered either in this film or subsequent films, but they don't matter because it's not essential for the story as it's moving forwards. So it's fine to just keep going, and I don't mind that at all. One of the things that helps this keep moving is the pace of it, which starts with a very interesting bust of there's a green prompt running a search program, and then we get the, you know, zooming in through the text, and then the first glimpse of the first whisper of Don Davis's French horns going crazy, and then we...
It's interesting on rewatching too, though, that opening dialogue, as a first time viewer, you have no idea what the hell these people are talking about, but in retrospect, Cypher is talking to Trinity about Neo, and the search program is giving away the fact that Cypher is already betraying them and they're following along. And, you know, right after the Trinity Neo or Trinity bust goes bad, the agents say the informant is real or whatever. Like, so basically this was a test. Like, if you can provide us someone, which he was trying to give up Trinity, then they'll believe you, and then you can cut your deal after that, which is, I think, interesting in retrospect, which I don't think I would have caught the first time seeing the movie.
Oh, yeah, I know I didn't catch it either, but, you know, I was 17. So
this whole movie is just, like, especially in 1989, the first time you see it, it's a whole lot of just, like, what in the hell is happening? Because, first of all, you get, like, okay, it's just computery, hackery guys, and the police are, you know, trying to track them down, and then all of a sudden one of them can do this crazy jump and kick stuff, and then that was weird, so maybe she's just like a crazy kung fu person, and then she disappears through a phone, and then a guy, well, we don't actually even see them morph where that before he Agent Smith is in the truck and crashes into the phone booth, but she picks up the phone and then suddenly she's gone. It's like, ooh, mystery. It's like the first, you know, couple scenes of this, you don't even get into like the whole you're in the computer world kind of, they, like, I like the way they draw out the reveal for this whole, you know, even just the mechanics behind getting in and out of the Matrix and all this stuff. It's never revealed right away, and they don't like talk down by explaining it from the very beginning, which is, it's fun to sort of like learn these things as you go. And they keep raising the stakes to like, oh, not only is a virtual presence and you're in the Matrix and now we're pulling you out. And it's like, it really makes it so when you actually pull out and you see that, the weird shot of Neo coming out of his like goop pod, you really go like, what in the hell? Where have they just taken us now? We're officially exiting the world as we know it. And it's actually, it's a really effective reveal because they didn't really hint at it too much.
Yeah. And I think they did a really good job balancing mystery versus just like confusing people because the stuff that's a mystery, they wind up explaining. Like, all of the stuff links up to other things. And you find out the story mechanics later on for all of the various aspects of the things that you saw in this opening scene. And like you're saying, the stuff with the informant and Cypher, et cetera, which we didn't catch on our viewings when we were younger. But you watch that on a rewatch, and it makes complete sense how these things all tie together. And you're also not bored because there's wacky stuff happening, and you don't know if Carrie Ann Moss is some sort of like supernatural person or if she has like superpowers or what the deal is. But she is just kicking everybody's butt.
And it's great because they use the same sort of mechanics you would use in a movie that where it was just, you know, they were actually like an underground group of terrorists trying to recruit other computer hackers to like be part of their group of terrorists. But it's led in that same sort of way, but they are that group, but they also exist in weird future world where they were like torn clothes with giant holes in them and stuff. So
yeah, and it's interesting because we go from this opening and them trying to monitor this person and switching shifts and like her getting out and stuff to Neo's life, where he is asleep at a computer, and it's doing searches for stuff. And if you watch on the monitor, you can see an image of Lawrence Fishburne in the sort of newspaper clippings that are
he's
slowly
searching for Morpheus. And I'm not sure why the newspaper clippings know the name Morpheus, but
I don't know.
It's there.
It's all in like different languages too, and it's all like progressive JPEGs. So they're like loading the images line by line, and which I find so incredibly entertaining these days. But
all the CRT monitors too are pretty great.
Oh, the best thing about the CRT monitors is this is back when you would still project the image of the screen onto someone's face so that it looked like whatever they were looking at on the screen was
cool looking, though.
No, it is always cheesy under any circumstances, and so I never like it. But
I thought it was cool, and then when it goes dark, he can feel the light is not on his face anymore, and he wakes up.
Yeah, but that could have just been accomplished with light.
I mean,
like if you sit in front of a CRT monitor, you're not going to get lines of text on your face. That's just not how it works.
Maybe you're not.
Yeah, sorry, Bill Pope. But so the he wakes up, and there's the wake up Neo and the instructions, etc. Follow the white rabbit, and then at the door, there's someone who's there who was late for his pickup, and you know he demands $2,000, and he fishes through a box of not a box, a hollowed out book of CDs and floppy disks and some of those old optical disk cartridge things.
Are they mini disks?
I can't tell exactly, but they might have been. Yeah, they could have been mini disks. But he hands one of them to the guy, and he's like, "Remember, can't be traced back to me. You don't know me." Blah 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 blah. And it's like, you know, you okay, man? It's like, yeah, you know, I just, you ever have these problems? He's like, yeah, mescaline. It's like, no.
So these like creepy, like underground raver drug addict guys are also illegal hackers or something.
Yeah, and then the lady friend has the white rabbit on her shoulder, and so he just goes with them and runs into Carrie Ann Moss, and they have a chit chat about Morpheus, and then
Rob Zombie remix playing in the club.
Yes,
this,
Dracula.
This movie actually had like a pretty rad soundtrack for the time.
It did, but I would say
it doesn't hold up now.
No, especially not the end credits. When you get to Marilyn Manson,
the end credits is Rage Against the Machine.
No, but right after Rage Against the Machine, it's Marilyn Manson.
Which song?
Next song, Rock Is Dead.
Oh yeah,
yeah. But anyway, of varying quality. They have
the propeller heads in there with the scene in the hallway and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Good, a few different things.
You got Rob D in that one song.
Yeah, and I think Rob D has some other stuff in the sequels. There's techno and there's rock and there's things. Stuff happens. But so anyway, in the club they have the chit chat, and then he's late to work because he slept in, and he gets grilled by his boss. And during the whole grilling scene, you're watching these people slowly wipe the windows outside. This is Chekhov's window wiping. Because he goes back to his desk, and agents are after him, and he gets a cell phone from FedEx, and it's the Nokia break your jaw phone that they stopped selling.
But don't forget the scene with the boss where he's, I find it kind of funny the way he keeps looking over at the window wipers, he's distracted or whatever, but it does a pretty good job of where he's getting berated by this boss with pretty perfunctory, like, you gotta be here, everyone else is here, the rules apply to everyone, including you. It's like, it, you know, the dialogue identically mirrors the whole story of the movie,
yeah,
as well, where he needs to break out and all that.
It's incredibly on the nose.
Once you've seen the movie, it is.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
But at the same time, it's just the same sort of like dressing down that you would get from a douchebag in a corner office if he works at a big company like that.
Yeah, well, there's nothing unusual about it, really, to be perfectly honest. It's honestly pretty mundane, but it's interesting, like you said, because of the parallels to the story that happened later on. But anyway, he goes back to his desk, and the agents are coming, and he's got the Nokia jawbreaker, and he gets out of the office by following the instructions. The first part I find hilarious, where he just hides behind a partial wall at the cubicle right behind his desk. And it was like, this is where you first start to get a glimpse of the incredibly variable skill set of the agents, where they can basically see through other people whenever they need to, except Neo, and they don't understand what he's doing, and they don't see through any of the other people in the office, but they're like literally standing one foot away from him, and they can supposedly see the Matrix and all this other stuff, and they're just idiots. But he goes past them to the window office, and he gets the instructions to go out on the ledge, and he's like, oh no, this is crazy, and he starts to go out there, and you think that he's actually going to do it and then go up the thing, and then he'll rendezvous with Morpheus, and then he'll do the stuff. But you are wrong, because they very cleverly had this scene where he chickened out. And
you gotta put the phone in your pocket is what you gotta do. You can't try and hold on to it while you're going around that thing.
Yeah, well, that was an idiot move, because at first he's trying to also do it while he's holding the phone in his hand, and it's like, no, you can't grab anything, don't do that. But once he drops it, then he's like, nope, forget this.
I would have just hung out on the ledge and like hid, because they wouldn't really like think to look over there, I don't think.
There was glass on the other side though, Dan.
Yeah, I know, but I think he was like around a corner that maybe he could just hide by that pillar.
That would not be an effective hiding place. They just see the open window and then somebody cowering out on the windowsill.
Could just lock that office door and then like hit under the desk or something.
I don't know. It's not important, Dad. Because the
Isn't
important
it, though?
thing, the important thing is that we see he chickened out and that he is abducted by the agents. And we don't know necessarily who the agents are. At this point in the film, we think they're just government agents, that they work for the government. They're government men sent from government. But they're just, they're not. There's something more nefarious than that. But we get a wall of old-fashioned CRT TVs with moire lines aplenty, and we go through them to the holding cell that he's in.
That's a cool shot, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when the stars start to drool, just like Pasta Fajoule, that's amore. But so they go into the holding cell.
I think you may have mixed a couple of the lines from that song.
Yeah. Well, stars start to shine like you have too much wine. That's amore. But anyway, so they get into the place, and we see the interrogation room. We have Agent Smith and the other agents who are, I don't know, do they have names?
Agent Brown and Agent Jones.
Oh. Which one was Stark from Farscape?
I don't know what Farscape is. Is that the is that the bulkier one or the skinnier one?
The skinnier one.
That was Paul Goddard, Agent Brown.
Yes, yes, yes. Paul Goddard, he played Stark on Farscape, which was a sci-fi show.
That is correct. He was also in Babe, apparently, in 1995.
Hmm. Good for him.
According to the internet.
But, they have this interrogation, mainly led by Agent Smith, and he does the sort of standard government intimidation tactics. And
the big old dossier, and he's slowly twirling the little piece of string that keeps it tied together, and Neo's looking over at the big file, and he recognizes something, and he knows he's in trouble because he sees a thing that he hacked, probably.
Yeah, one of the things I find incredulous about this and the previous scene where he's on the ledge and he's murmuring to himself is that he thinks he's done nothing wrong and would like a phone call, and it's like, you have done lots of things wrong, sir.
No. He's a Redditor. He knows his rights, man. Like, I don't have to talk to you. Get me my lawyer.
Yeah, libertarians. But so he,
I think one of my least favorite things about this movie in terms of what holds up is the practical makeup that closes his mouth in this scene is bad. So like the little
stretching of his face is also not so great because
it's
like,
not terrible because it's short, but like after like once they switch from the CG to the physical, it really just looks like they just stretched some latex around him and like kind of painted on some stubble. It does not look like his face at all.
No, but the CG one is also not great because you can see the texture stretching, meaning that what appears to be photographs of his face that they use for the textures are skewing and stretching, and so you see like these long vertical patches of skin that would not be shaped like that, and it's all gooey.
I feel like it was another part of the movie where there was also some stretchy textures.
Yeah, well, they do that, and then they're like, aha, and now I'm going to put this thing in you, and he sticks the little tiny...
Well, it's good because he's like, you know, what good's a phone call if you can't speak, which sounds like they're just going to, like, beat him up and break his job. It's like, no, they're gonna use magic to make your mouth seal shut, and then they're going to put a robot shrimp in your belly button.
Yeah, which is interesting because if they had this sort... This is one of those things, like I said, the variable powers and capabilities of the agents that fluctuate scene to scene. If you could just close anybody's mouth whenever you wanted to, then why not?
A feature of the room.
This is a special mouth closing room.
The room is it's in a special building where they have access to mouth closing programs.
Yeah, that's certainly plausible. Or all three of them together using their agent powers, all focused on the same person's mouth.
Powers combined, we can execute the mouth closing program or whatever.
Yes. Like you're saying, they take the shrimp and they stick it in his belly button. He wakes up and he's like, oh, it must have just been a bad dream or whatever. But then he gets a phone call. This line is tapped, so go do the stuff before they trace it. And so he goes down there, and no one's following him. If you were tapping the line, wouldn't you just show up, too? I don't know. And he goes into the suicide doors of what appears to be Lincoln Continental, and then he's seated next to Carrie Ann Moss, who he's met before, at the party, as well as Switch is sitting in the front, and she pulls a gun on him, and Apoc's driving. Switch is like, you know, don't resist, don't put up a fight, and don't do stuff, or I'll have to kill you. And feels like this is a really harsh tactic to take immediately right off the bat, but Neo thinks he's going to go, because she says, you know, it's our way or the highway, and he's like, okay, well, I'm just going to leave then. And he opens the suicide door again, and he goes to get out, and Carrie Ann Moss is like, please, Neo, no, don't go, because you're really important, just do this thing. I was like, all right, fine. And then she's like, okay, now I'm going to take out my shrimp extractor.
plug it into the cigarette lighter and switch on the whatcha-who's-it thingy-mabob, the big power source.
Yeah, you know, you just go down to the local bodega and get your shrimp extractor. See, this is... There are a couple times in this film where they have equipment that seemingly makes no sense.
My favorite nonsensical equipment is the VR goggles that Cypher puts on in the mirror arm room.
Yeah.
What are you looking at? Also, if this is the room where you've done this extraction for all these people, do you just have like all this equipment set up in the closet of this room in this abandoned hotel permanently? Because it feels like at some point the agents are just gonna like sneak in and like take all your weird phone dialing VR goggle stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, hypothetically, I guess they could get all this stuff from the construct before they go in, just like they get all the guns and stuff.
Carried around in all of those big Pelican cases or whatever, where they have the big guns.
Yeah, but I guess who designs this thing? It's like, yeah, so...
They do. They're all hackers, man.
No, but, like, how do you know... How do you gain the knowledge to know that someone would have a shrimp inside of their belly button?
Well, you just think, what would I do? You would do it. You would run a trace program, but then what would be the physical embodiment of a trace program? And the answer is clearly a shrimp in your belly button.
Yeah, I feel like this is one of those things that's just here to weird you out. This is a Cronenberg moment of body horror, where, you know, it's not even that horrific, but it's like, you know, skin crawling. You know, stuff coming out of your navel is not great, into or out of, They suction it right out, and there's blood, and it goes in the little tube thing, and then they throw it out the window, and then it turns back into a little diode or whatever it was, and the light goes off, which is an interesting concept, because basically the thing that made it this animated monstrosity was something other than its specific physical properties. Or apparent physical properties, I should say. But they go to the thing, and they introduce him to Morpheus, and we get the sunglasses. Lot of indoor sunglasses in this film. A lot of very highly reflective indoor sunglasses.
They don't need glasses to see, because it's a computer program.
Yeah, well, they wear their sunglasses at night, so they can see the Matrix. But they chit chat for a bit, and he's like, I got a choice to do this thing, red pill or blue pill. And it's a very iconic scene. You'll often hear referenced of people presenting a choice in red pill or blue pill. And then so he goes ahead and he takes a pill.
Neo drank at least half that glass of water to make sure that it was properly hydrated as it went down.
Yeah, it was one of those big NyQuil suckers. Like, you can't just swallow that dry.
I mean,
it's not happening.
No, you can't swallow it dry, but like, a sip of water, you'd be fine. You don't need to drink the whole thing.
Oh, maybe he was thirsty. He just lost some blood from the thing coming at him.
It was pouring buckets and gallons of water outside.
Okay, well, I mean, he wasn't sipping it. He didn't have his mouth open out the window going, I'm Keanu Reeves, I'm just drinking water.
He could have, though. There was an easy opportunity to drink lots of water.
I just feel like that would be a very different film. they do this thing, and then they go back to the room where they stage all the weird nonsensical equipment, and he sits down on the chair, and they put the diodes on, and they're all doing nonsense. And then he looks over at the broken mirror, and it's not clear if they always just have, like, a broken mirror for this part of the procedure, if it's just like, Yeah, so we always need to have the broken mirror. It needs to be right here, and he needs to touch it so that it can crawl down his throat. Like, is that a necessity, or is that just some anomaly of this specific process?
That seems weird. That scene feels like it's there because they needed some tech. But I did really appreciate that the this is one of the instances where, you know, I think something that's, you know, again, that the red pill, blue pill thing that is parodied and referenced a lot after this. It's a very serious scene, and I think in other movies, it's done in sort of a very serious fashion, but there are really not super serious consequences to it. Whereas in this one, he kind of downplays it, which is kind of why Cypher gets pissed off later. But, you know, the whole, like, all I'm offering you is the truth, and this, you know, very serious tone of voice, and it's like, why is he being so, like, cryptic and serious? But then, as it turns out, like, there are incredibly serious consequences to making this decision, and it's actually kind of horrifying once you see all of his weird tubes and electricity and stuff, which, by the way, the electricity in this is probably my least favorite visual effect in this whole movie. But I like that they addressed the scene and the consequences with the appropriate amount of seriousness.
Yeah, I feel like this is not a fair induction process, though, because there really is not going back on this. And if you find out the world around you is not real and that you're actually in some far future wasteland, maybe you would be less inclined to take this particular pill.
Well, but he explains it. He does say that. But then at the end, he's like, yeah, I can't really explain it to you. You're going to have to see it. But he does say, like, you know, everything around you is the Matrix. I mean, he could be a little less coy and be like, oh, yeah, Everything around you is the Matrix. Like, he could be like, no, literally, you're in a computer simulation. I know it doesn't feel like it, but you're in a computer simulation.
He's not as forthcoming. Like, if somebody sold you a car and they were just like, I have a car to sell you, and I can't tell you anything about this car, but
imagine a world where you would sit down and operate pedals and a steering wheel, and it would take you anywhere you want to go in your own personal vehicle. It's like, okay, that describes anything from, like, a golf cart to a Rolls Royce, and then suddenly you're in a golf cart.
Yeah, you want the blue key or the red key?
Whichever one fits in the Rolls Royce. I don't think they're blue or red.
Well, then you'd be picking the blue key because ignorance is bliss.
I would totally want to be, like, rich and powerful and stuff and stupid, but, like, not, like, go back. I don't know. Would you rather be rich and powerful and dumb in the Matrix or, like, the ability to fly and jump really far and beat everybody up and be out of the Matrix?
It's confusing. So,
do you want to be Neo or do you want to be Cypher?
Well, of course I would want to be Neo, because Cypher dies.
Okay, I mean, if Cypher would have succeeded in his plan.
But he's also a murderer.
Well, okay, so not literally Cypher. Would you take the agent's deal, or would you rather eat a bowl of snot and live in the ship and just have superpowers in a computer?
I would do the latter, because I would be so guilt-ridden that I would not live well, which is part of the reason why Cypher says that he wants to not remember any of this.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So you wouldn't take the deal if they could erase your memories?
No, Cypher also doesn't have any insurance that they're actually going to do any of this. Mm. They could just kill him and dump him in a pit. Like, nobody's going to care.
Makes you wonder why they don't have, like, maybe they do, and this is just the boring parts of the movie that we don't actually see. Like, they should all have, like, Sunday dinner in the construct where they could just have, like, Thanksgiving and steak and other wonderful meals and then, like, pretend to eat it and enjoy it in their little brain and then go back to their depressing ship world afterward.
Well, also, I must say that they are incredibly unimaginative when it comes to the computer part of this, where they could be anyone or do anything. Instead, they just sort of see themselves with, like, haircuts.
I think part of that is supposed to be, like, the subconscious portion of your brain, not, like, actively, like, I wish I was more attractive and I was 10 pounds lighter and more buff.
No, but Morpheus says that it's your residual self-image right when you go into the construct program. But that's not something that always functions going forwards, because they can make themselves look slightly different. They can wear different sunglasses or coats or whatever, and they can style their hair however they want to whenever in there. They don't have to have the buzz cut that they have outside in the real world. but you know, they can however much hair gel they want. But there is no one who's imaginative with this process for how they see themselves inside of the Matrix. Whereas if you take people in the real world and you give them an MMORPG or whatever, and they're like, I'm going to play as this lady who's going to go crush all this stuff, and then I'm going to play as this dude who's going to do this other thing. And it's like, okay, you're playing these things that are nothing like you, and that's part of that experience. But with the Matrix, everybody's basically themselves.
I feel like to work in the Matrix, you kind of have to have like a borderline personality disorder, because you kind of know what you look like. And as much as you would like to be different, I don't think you can just, like, imagine yourself different.
Oh, well, that goes against all the other things that he says about, like, you're not actually breathing, those aren't actually muscles, like, you can do whatever you want, there isn't a spoon.
When you close your eyes, you still know what you look like.
Okay. Anyway, I'm just saying. they could have been more imaginative, but, anywho, they have the process of his induction, where he is awoken inside of the thing and he looks over around and sees all the horrific battery farm pods everywhere. And it's very H.R. Giger-esque. And there's a dragonfly-looking bulbousy thing that comes up and scans him and takes out a syringe but doesn't use it and just unplugs him and then flushes him. And he unfortunately has some horrible makeup appliance where they put some fake skin on top of his skin, and it gets all wrinkly and bunched up, which I don't care for. But he gets sucked out of the thing and lands in the sewer, and then they get him with the harness that specifically covers up his genitalia, and then they dump him on the floor and put a nice little comfy blanket on him, and then just start shooting him up full of... cocktails to fix all the atrophied bone and tissue damage and stuff.
I like that they didn't immediately go to like, all right, you're out, let's go be a superhero. Like, there's like time lapse cross dissolve of hours and hours of acupuncture and sleeping and rest and procedures and stuff to try and like make him into just like a regular human being again.
Yeah, and when he is finally up and about, he's not a superhuman. Or even really specifically up at the level he was at inside of the Matrix. He seems very out of it still. And that's especially true when, he gets nauseous and pukes all over the floor. But he's definitely, he shows, they did a good job showing his growing, to understand the real world, and himself inside of the real world, relative to the way he felt about himself when he was inside of the Matrix, which I feel is necessary for this sort of thing. And one of the things that helps is the way they shot this. They had his head shaved for these scenes where he's in the real world, and that gives you that division, that separation, which for anyone who might be wondering, they do that by shaving his head and filming those scenes and then not having his head shaved and filming the other scenes. But it's magic. It's movie magic. And you just do it with
shooting
editing.
Out of sequence.
Yeah. So it's relatively simple to do that, and it works well. Because there are a lot of times when you watch movies and stuff where it's like, oh, and then they're supposed to be in two different places or out of time or whatever, and it's like they look exactly the same. Like, their hair is just a little messed up. Like, you guys just didn't... Because a lot of people are reluctant, I would say, to shave their heads for things or to grow ridiculous mustaches for certain roles, and to have to shave them for reshoots of certain Superman properties. But
and then you've got, like, the opposite end of the spectrum where you've got, like, Rooney Mara in Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, who got a weird haircut, like, pierced everything on her body, like, shaved off her eyebrows and bleached them blonde, and it's like... She committed harder to that than most people.
Yes. But anywho, they start his training, the construct, et cetera, and how he's got to learn to see the world differently. The loading program, the training program with I Know Kung Fu, one of the very famous lines from this film, because they downloaded it into his brain. And then he's able to do that, and he's fighting Morpheus. And there's this really cheesy moment where it's like, oh, Neo's fighting Morpheus, and they all like gather around to look at the screen. It's like, you guys are nerds. Like, nobody would do that. Like, it's not that big of a deal.
They think that their boss thinks that he's the one who's gonna bring salvation to the human race, and he's finally getting his learnings on, and Morpheus is testing it, so they want to see how it goes.
It's like the first time he fought him.
Plus, it's like, so, you know, the most entertainment they get around there. I don't think they get like, you know, SpongeBob or whatever.
but
do you think they could load a loading program where they just have like a massive DVD collection and they can just watch movies and stuff?
But it seems pretty reasonable since they have access to that sort of stuff.
Know part of like what happened in the war with the humans and the robots, so maybe they don't have like the entire Disney catalog.
No, but they could get approximations of it from the Matrix. But since they can get like building plans and stuff from the Matrix.
That's a good point. Do you think they can download stuff from the Matrix? Like they can pirate the Matrix?
I believe so, because he gets the building plans. He's able to look that up on, like, I don't know, the Matrix internet or whatever. And then
no, that would be the Matrix's intranet. They've hacked into the Matrix's Slack channel and they're like looking through the backlog of uploaded files.
Yeah. They also have their own form of entertainment, as Mouser points out when he talks about how he programmed the lady in the red dress and how she doesn't talk very much, but she can be available for private occasions. And it's like, that's disgusting.
Well, he's a teenager, so it's natural that the first thing he does when he gets out into the Matrix is program a girlfriend.
Not really a girlfriend, by definition.
Yeah, well... someone to accompany him.
Mm-hmm. Also, I'm not entirely sure, but did he play you want to buy some death sticks guy that was in Attack of the Clones?
I have no idea who that is. You want to buy some death sticks?
Yeah, the guy who approaches Obi-Wan at the thing.
He is in Attack of the Clones. His name is Ellen Sleaze Bagano.
Yeah, well, that's because George Lucas is so good at naming things.
Elan Yelan Sleaze Bagano.
Yes, he's the Death Sticks guy. He says, you want to buy some Death Sticks? And then they put antennas on him.
Oh, his second IMDb photo is him handing something to Obi-Wan at a bar. Yeah.
Death Sticks. And then he says, you don't want to sell me Death Sticks. I don't want to sell you Death Sticks. You want to go home and rethink your life? I want to go home and rethink my life. And then he goes away.
Yeah, and in this movie, his name is Mouse.
Yeah.
You think that was actually his hacker name before he came into the Matrix?
I have no idea. But he seems mouse-like. And they seem to be casting him in that manner. But anyway, they have the whole thing with the jump program and... how he's got to, you know, learn about the agents and anybody could become an agent. And this gives us story mechanics that we were missing at the beginning of this, but are essential to our understanding of things going forwards. And we find them out in a way that makes us go, oh, that's interesting. That's why that happened. Not in a way that's like, we already know that dude, because there wasn't a scene where that was explained earlier in the film, because otherwise this would be very frustrating to sit through, which is a good way to structure this, because we get the mystery and we get the payoff with this. And then we get to the scene where they go inside of the Matrix to go see the Oracle. This is, of course, after Joe Pantoliano has sold them all out. And he has a little scene with Neo where he's like, oh, yeah, you know, why didn't I take the blue pill? Which is nice. Joe Pantoliano was well cast for this.
Yeah, you're just thinking like, oh, is he just like sassy, grumpy guy part of the group? Or like, oh no, this is foreshadowing to come. Yeah. Although it's like...
very obvious that he's not a good person.
Yeah, pretty obvious.
Also, the way he talks to Trinity, where he's like, oh, you know, you were all interested in him, and I wish you were interested in me. It's like, ugh, gross. Gross dude. But yeah.
He's got weird facial hair.
He's just upset because he has weird facial hair and a lot of economic anxiety about where he fits into the world.
He wants to be somebody important, like an actor, which I thought was funny.
Somebody rich, like an actor, which was especially hilarious because I don't believe Joe Pantoliano or Hugo Weaving was rich at this point in their career.
Was this prior to he was in Sopranos, wasn't he?
Joe Pantoliano?
Yeah.
Sure. I didn't watch Sopranos.
I didn't either, but I figured that would have been
He's in Bad Boys 2, which is before this, right?
And The Fugitive. Was Bad Boys 2 before this? I feel like it was like right after this.
I think it was before this. I think it was like 97 or 98.
2003, Bad Boys 2.
Oh, really? Wow. So I guess it was after this.
Did you ever see Ready to Rumble?
No.
It's a funny movie. You should. I mean, you'll hate it, but it's a funny movie. He's in that too.
Oh, it's my favorite kind of movie.
it's with David Arquette and Scott Kahn and Oliver Platt, and it's like a WWE wrestling kind of parody thing. It's funny.
Well, thank you for listing a lot of people that have no interest in seeing work together.
You know, it's also got Rose McGowan, huh?
They have their little exchange about him being the one and whatever, and then they're gonna go see the Oracle.
Bad Boys 1 in 1995.
Okay, but I don't remember what he did in that one. But so anyway, they have the scene where they're gonna go see the Oracle, and they all go in, all of them, except for Tank and Dozer, who stay back because of course they can't plug into the Matrix.
You think they're like super bummed that they can't go in and play around in like superhero world?
I don't know. I mean, because there are some drawbacks.
There are certainly drawbacks. But like, even just to go into like the construct and like play around, like I would hang out in the construct all day long.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's one of those things where people criticize Star Trek because of holodecks and stuff, and it's just like if you had a holodeck, if you could like materialize anything you wanted, you wouldn't do anything else. Like you just do whatever you wanted to do in there all day. And I mean, you know, I have a feeling though the novelty wears off because you don't get new experiences. You're just doing whatever it is that fulfills your wishes. Just like people who have a lot of money can buy a lot of things, but then they run out of the imagination of the things that they want to have.
Well, I mean, they could all be in the construct together and do stuff, though.
Yeah, I suppose.
I mean, what a retired person would do. You would like watch some movies, go play around the golf, like I don't know, go swimming, go water skiing or something.
I don't know. I think this is why they have the massive orgies in Zion, though.
Probably. The rave orgies.
Not to get ahead of ourselves in our world building. Somebody's
got to repopulate Earth.
they go to see the Oracle, and there's that shot we discussed earlier of the camera panning around the ringing phone, and they're all just there. And they answer the phone.
Poster poses.
it's a very silly moment. And then they go walk out to the car, switch mouse, Epoch stay behind, and Joe Pantoliano drops the Nokia Jawbreaker phone into the trash can after dialing it, and it rings and it rings and it rings, so we know obviously that he has let the agents know their location. They go off to the Oracle, and there's a odd moment in the car where Neo asks Trinity what the Oracle had told her, and she's like, "The Oracle told me," and then she just stops talking, and it's like, okay, and then he prompts her again, and she's like, "The Oracle told me," and okay, just trailing off again, like I don't know what that's about. But then they arrive at the location, and then he goes into the place, up the elevator, and Morpheus is like, you know, just go in and do your stuff, and you know the Oracle told me I'd find you. And then
how many people in this movie say a bit of advice and then say something to him and then go about their business? I think it happens like 5 times.
Keanu strikes me as somebody who needs a lot of advice. But he goes inside of the place, and there's a lady who escorts him to a living room, which is functioning as a waiting room, and there's all the gifted kids, which are also maybe kind of candidates to be the one.
Yeah, the other potentials.
Yeah, and there's what appear to be twins playing with some old-fashioned like wood blocks with letters on them by levitating them in the air between one another, and then there's another kid who appears to be British, I guess, but also like in Buddhist monk clothes with a shaved head, and he's just bending a spoon. And Neo sits down to chit-chat with him, and he's like, "Do not bend the spoon, because that is impossible. Realize that there is no spoon." And then you get
that was a very good impression.
Bad CG of the reflection of that spoon bending. It doesn't look anything like the practical spoon. And then they have Neo go off to go talk to the Oracle, and she's baking a cookie and takes the cookies out of the oven. It's a weird kitchen too. I've never seen a split height oven before, where it comes up above the countertop, but also doesn't extend to the floor. It's very strange. But I assume that's one of the more peculiar aspects of the set construction when you're dealing with Australia, maybe. She takes out the cookies and, you know, have the chat. And it's like, yeah, you know, you're not the one. You know, you're waiting for something. And this is how you can tell that he's obviously the one and she's just lying to him. She's like, you know, don't worry about it. You know, Morpheus, poor Morpheus, you know, you're gonna have to sacrifice yourself for him or whatever. But, you know, you're gonna go walk out of here and you're gonna, you know, tell yourself, yeah, I don't believe in all this fake crap. And then you're gonna feel a lot better. Have this cookie, you'll feel as right as rain. I love all this stuff with her. She's wonderful as the Oracle.
He goes out of there. Though.
What?
She overcooked her cookies.
They seemed a little crisp.
Yeah, it made a cracking noise, like when he bit into it. It was like, you just pulled those out of the oven. If they're that hard, you destroyed them.
Maybe it was all like staging, clever staging. Also, if the cookie is supposed to make you feel right as rain, maybe it's like a piece of programming code that she has doctored up.
Mm-hmm. I thought that too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also, they're particularly vague about the Oracle, what she is in relation to the world around you.
Yeah, I feel like that's because they didn't know and didn't really feel like answering it until they had to in the second movie.
Yeah. So you don't know if she's a program or if she's a person. And
she's been with them since the beginning.
Yeah, since the beginning of the Resistance, which is questionable. But so they go, he goes back into the hallway, meets Morpheus, and Morpheus is like, don't tell me. Whatever she said to you is between you and her. And it's like, wait, dude, you just told me what she'd said to you about me, so why wouldn't I tell, other than the constructs of the story, it doesn't make any sense. But, so they
just
go back to the car.
Neo's a newbie, and he's not allowed to tell his first Oracle reading.
the first Oracle reading is the deepest, but, so they go to...
Is that one, from Sheryl Crow?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe
how in our BS episode before did we not cover the concert?
I don't know. It just didn't come up. But so they vacate there, go back to the place, and then it's like, oh, deja vu. I just saw this cat that went by and then went by again. It's like, oh no, it's the same cat. Deja vu means a glitch in the Matrix. And then everybody in the audience is going, oh my god, I've experienced deja vu before. Am I in the Matrix? And it's like, no, audience, calm down.
The mixing of these two storylines, while you've got this one character who is learning and getting into this world and learning to become successful in the world, you've got this other character who just wants desperately to get out of it. And as they cross paths, you know, he's basically causing everyone else to get killed in between, and then that creates the conflict that ends the movie.
Yes. Yeah.
I think it works pretty well.
Yeah, fair Verona. But so they have the thing where they go back inside and then they realize that all the windows have been turned to brick, because that's the glitch in the Matrix, that they had rewritten the building.
And they couldn't just rewrite the building without a hard line. They had to cut it with bolt cutters.
Yeah, variable powers of
I mean,
the
like,
agents.
How else are you going to like visibly show like, oh, the phone's no longer connected? Unless you would have had like him pick up the phone and just like there'd be nothing there.
What if the phone turned to bricks?
Like in his hand, like as he picks it up and holds it up to his ear, he's just like the camera does a 360 around him and suddenly he's holding a brick to the side of his head.
That would have been funny.
then he could have like thrown it at the door when the SWAT team breaks through.
Yeah, but mouse goes down pretty easy.
He had those cool guns though, with the big like circular drums of shotgun shells around his hands.
I don't know exactly the mechanics of that one, but it doesn't. The one problem with his strategy was that there was zero cover for him, so he just got shut up real quick.
I don't think the leather high back chair he was sitting in would have really been sufficient for all of the M16s that the SWAT guys were carrying.
No, there was no way out of this.
Although
for him.
He is small, so he could have just like hid for a little while.
I guess.
I mean, very few people in this movie think that hiding is an okay way of like avoiding agents and police and stuff.
Well, that's a good segue because they go hide in a wall. And then they start slowly going down the gap in the wall until, hilariously, somebody kicks the dust from the plaster and lathe wall, and it goes down and lands on Joe Pantoliano's face, and he sneezes, and that alerts the SWAT team, military team, whatever. They're very nondescript about exactly what enforcement agency this is. That alerts them to the presence inside the walls. They start shooting through the walls. Agent Smith gets Neo through the wall, and then Morpheus busts out of the wall and lands on top of Agent Smith, and everybody's like, oh no, Morpheus, and then Carrie Ann Moss is like, he told us to go, and she yanks down on him, and they fly down the rest of the way, scraping all the lathe and plaster. Meanwhile, Agent Smith and Lawrence Fishburne just sit on top of each other for a couple of seconds, and then we go back to the basement, and they're there, and they're getting out, and then we go back to Lawrence Fishburne, and he's still on top of Agent Smith. I'm not sure why they staged it quite that way, to have them have so many shots of them just sitting on top of each other while everyone else is running around, but
well,
whatever.
They had to have their... well, if it isn't the famous Morpheus conversation before they started fighting.
Yeah, and Morpheus puts up a fight, but not enough of a fight. He goes down. Because as Morpheus had pointed out earlier, you don't want to go up against an agent. You want to run because they're like going to totally beat your butt.
They've killed everyone who's ever fought.
I mean, it's hard to fight something that you can't kill. Like, it just jumps to another nearby human being. Seems a bit of a challenge. But they capture Morpheus. Joe Pantoliano gets caught, quote unquote, kind of, and escapes and like calls up to find the hard line.
Oh yeah, when he does his like fake like, oh, I tripped whilst diving to the escape hatch that you guys are already in, and then yeah, he just goes out the side because they let him go.
Uh huh. Yeah.
There was a car accident. I don't know how to explain it, but somebody up there still likes me. It's like, wait, are you saying, like, God helped you out of this? Is that what that's supposed to be a reference to? But, like, we're in the Matrix world where there's robots and things.
You know, he's got a sense of humor. So he gives him the directions of the hard line, and he beats the other people there first. Uses the hard line to go into the real world and start destroying everything. And this is a very tense, dramatic scene because then Joe Pantoliano gets to do his Bond villain pantomime about how he's going to slowly off everybody on the team because he's going to get his wish to go back inside of the Matrix. And he starts straddling everyone while he kills them, which is an interesting move. And then he yanks the plug out of the back of their skulls, which, as you know, if you die in the Matrix, you die in real life. And if you don't hardline your telephones back to your skulls, you die. I don't know. So I wonder if
when he does that, the computer says disk not properly ejected.
Oh, that'd be funny. You can't just, you know, you gotta unmount the drive.
And there's no way to, like, plug back in and remount and then, like, resuscitate the person on Matrix Earth.
It seems like a really bad file system. I don't know.
You know what the Matrix needs? The Matrix needs Time Machine and Backblaze is what it needs.
Well, it needs a good journaled file system so that it can know where it left off and you won't get corruption.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. But anyway.
Two is one. And one is none, as they say.
Oh dear. So they do the whole thing of unplugging Epoch, and then he goes to unplug Switch, which is a shame because while Switch did virtually nothing in the film, for some reason I found her appealing in a way that I wanted to see more of Switch because she happened to be the only character wearing white, and her like platinum Swedish blonde hair seemed vaguely interesting. In a gallery of people all with black slicked back hair, but She died, and she has the notable line of, no, not like this, not like this, and then
and the eyes rolling back in the head and falling down is
she's done. And Joe Pantoliano is like, oh, I'm gonna take care of Neo now, and blah 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 blah, and he makes the classic Bond villain mistake of talking, because Tank was not completely killed because of the original misfire, and so he kills Joe Pantoliano.
It's a little funny, though, because he's like, if he's the one, there's literally no way I could kill him, right? And then all of a sudden he starts going, no, wait, oh no, and then Tank's there with the laser gun or whatever, and then...
What a coinkydink.
Yeah, so, boom, proven. By the transitive property of inability to kill Neo, he must be the one now.
Yeah, and well, or just incredibly lucky, but...
There's no such thing as luck in the Matrix.
Well, they didn't test his theory specifically, but they get back out of there, and they deal with the aftermath of this, and then they're like, oh no, we got to go back in and get Morpheus, because he's got the codes to Zion's mainframe, and they want that, and so they're going to interrogate him.
It's either that or kill him.
Kill him, yeah. And they're like, no, we can't kill him. Neo says that the Oracle had told him that the prophecy that she had revealed to him was that he was gonna have to sacrifice his own life in order to protect Morpheus, and so they decide to skedaddle back in there, and they're like, oh, we're just gonna have to stock up on guns and construct loading up on the guns, and then back in the Matrix, that you get that cool helicopter shot of it going up to the mirrored front of the building, symmetry, exciting stuff. And they have him there, and they shoot him up with whatever, I don't know, hacker juice. And they start interrogating him about things. And Agent Smith is meandering in a weird conversation about humanity's the virus, and we're the cure, and blah 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 blah. And, like, you're disease and things. He's unwell.
It's interesting, though, because he's giving his philosophical perspective, which is, as long as we can crush the human resistance, the Matrix can run self-sustained, and there will be no need for us agents as peacekeepers, and then I can finally get out. Like, I don't know where he plans to go.
Basically, yeah, like, what is he going to do? He just retired to a farm in Montana?
Yeah, he just wants to die, apparently. He wants to be, like, decommissioned. He wants to have his mini-disc put back in the book or something.
I don't know. It seems... I mean, it's hard to... I guess it's hard to understand the motivations of a program that is written to do the things that he's written to do, because what possible self-fulfillment kind of things could he want if he's designed to have ambitions that are purely based on hunting other humans?
Yeah, then it's like if a program is no longer useful, you don't, like, leave it installed so it can go do something else that it was not programmed to do. You uninstall
spoiler
it.
Spoiler alert for the sequels.
When we get to the sequels, we're going to have to analyze that whole concept, because I don't think it works, because programs don't run on human brains.
Well, Dan, does it not work, or does it not work because it's not supposed to not work, because it's all part of the plan? But anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves. The important thing here is
that... Did you know that in movies, everything is intentional all the time?
It's a good point. No, but they established that Agent Smith is clearly different from the other agents in this particular scene, surely.
He's the leader, and he's got some ambitions, and he's got some... Not all of his motivations are for the group. Some are for himself, because he doesn't like humans. And not only does he not like humans and want to exterminate them, he just wants to get away from all of them because they're gross and he's had enough of it.
Yeah, and Jones and Brown or whatever, they are much more by the book, and they just want to send Sentinels and do the thing and just, you know, kill the people, whatever. Like, they won't get the codes to Zion's mainframe, but this is the least risky way of going about it. And meanwhile, Agent Smith is like, no, I have to know, and I have to do this thing, you know? So he has a bit of an obsession, which is something that the other agents don't seem to have. The lobby scene that happens is notable, because there's a lot of bullets and slow motion and running up walls and... things and killing and lots of explosions.
And techno music.
And techno music, and yes. Then,
but, you know, the problem with the scene is obviously, as the movie up until this point has illustrated for us, all these people that are being killed are just real people who are just in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, and this is something that goes back to the training program where Morpheus had justified killing these people because he's like, you know, they're, you know, just people, but you don't know if they're gonna, they could turn on you and become an agent or anything else, and so you can't, like, I guess, feel anything for them. I have a logical disconnect with that philosophy. Like, I feel like they really should have invested in non-lethal means of removing people.
Only super smart dark web hacker bros are the ones who are capable of being, you know, unleashed and set free. So everyone else is just a battery for the robots. And the sooner they die, the better.
You can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs, right? So they're breaking all the eggs. In the lobby,
yeah.
The eggs have been pulverized. Because they're also, let's just say this: even though they have superhuman speed and accuracy, they take some really sloppy weaponry to turn people into meatloaf. there is an excess to the violence that occurs. Where if you were actually just trying to, I don't know, get these people out of their misery or whatever. From living in the Matrix, their security guard lifestyle, then there would be more efficient ways to dispatch them than just mowing everyone down. But
they loaded their own helicopter in the construct in the first place and then just flown up to the side.
Yeah, I don't know. But this is the way they do it. I mean, it's obviously one of those moments in the film where they wanted to have a big action set piece, and so here it is, and they blow up the lobby, and there's a bouncing CG door, and
to this day, I remember the bouncing CG door because when the trailer came out, that shot was in the trailer, but they hadn't yet rendered the door, so there's no door in it, and then when I saw the movie, I'm like, oh, look at that, they added a door. Interesting. Mm-hmm.
Well, also, you can tell it's a CG door because it looks like a CG door. But they, it's not that bad, but it's not great. So they go up to the top, and they're on the roof, and they take care of some guards, and then one of the agents, the taller one, shows up on the roof, and then Neo's shooting at him, but he's dodging all the bullets. And one of the things that I find especially hilarious about this is because you get the really neat effect of sort of this time echo kind of thing happening where you get him dodging from the torso up in all these different poses, but while that's neat, just shoot him in the legs. He can't move everywhere, just shoot him. I don't know, he seems focused on shooting him in the torso, but then, you know, this is where you first get Neo moving like they do, where he goes to dodge the stuff, and you get the big fancy bullet time shot, mm-hmm. which is the John Gaeta technique of arranging a bunch of little cameras and having them go off in sequence around somebody as they're moving.
Well, they also did that in the opening scene with Trinity when she did her praying mantis jump and kicked the guy in the face. But in that, remember I told you I listened to that really annoying Bill Pope podcast where he was talking about Baby Driver? In that one, he mentioned that the camera array, they only had one day or like a day and a half to shoot with this thing. So every bullet time camera move in the movie, which I think there are three, has the same camera move because they didn't have the time and or money to like set them up in different ways. I think they may have, I don't know, either digitally or practically changed the tilt in one or two of them. But it's the same camera move around the people every time.
Yeah. Also, I think they truncated the move on Trinity.
Oh yeah. When her too. But they definitely truncated it on the one where Lawrence Fishburne gets shot in the ankle. If that was indeed actually part of the rig, still, that one might have been like a CG world morph thing.
Yeah. Well, it's like water and all kinds of other stuff. But so they, while it's not the first bullet time shot in the film, it is the biggest one. In this rooftop
it's
scene,
the shot.
The shot.
The iconic one.
So, yeah. So he's all flipped over backwards, flailing around, and he gets grazed by a couple bullets, and he falls backwards. And then, you know, Trinity's like, oh, how'd you do that? You move like they do. And, you know, not well enough. But before that, the agent is taunting him or whatever over his corpse or something. And then she's just like, dodge this, and shoots him in the face. And then the agent materializes out of there, and it turns back into the person that he had seized.
Yeah, a nice slow motion shot as his body is flying like a rag doll, which is exactly what happens when you shoot somebody in the side of the head.
No, also she doesn't move. But the recoil on something like that would, I don't know, seem like it would make her move a little. But
it was the fisheye lens is why she didn't do that.
Of course. But then they had the helicopter and download the flight whatever's, and they hop on there, and then they go down to the window and they mow down everything with the Gatling gun that they have for that, and they kill the agents in there. But then they respawn back inside of the hallway, but they get Lawrence Fishburne, they coach him out of there. He breaks the one little weak link in the chain and runs out of there and gets shot in the calf midway, and so Neo has to jump after him, and there's just action on top of action. Then they drag the helicopter over. But the Agent Smith shoots the fuel line or something? I don't know.
You just put a couple bullets next to the exhaust on the part of the jet engine exhaust part of the turbine thing there, and then, of course, it crashes.
Yeah, it seemed to cause a disproportionate amount of damage, but who knows? Maybe they're special fancy bullets. And then they start going down. They drop off Lawrence Fishburne on the roof, and then Neo, and then he keeps the rope because Trinity's got to get off, and she shoots the thing to sever it, which seems like, I don't know, more trouble than it's worth or whatever.
Well, if the line is already like tightening because you know it's pulling in, you can't really like undo the clip or whatever. But yeah, it's super cool, and it's all in like super slow motion because Neo's all fast and the helicopter is crashing into the building.
Yeah, and so she goes swinging backwards, and then you get like a shot of her black levels not matching, and the helicopter smashes into the side of the building, and there's a ripple,
and a train sound effect,
which doesn't make any sense, and more horns, and then the explosion, and she slams into the glass in the building where the camera is apparently, between the camera and Trinity, and then she gets hauled up, and they all get escorted to safety.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe now? Look what he just did. That was so cool. Only the one would be able to do that.
Yeah, and so they go to the subway station where they're all going to get out of there, and Lawrence Fishburne, it's like, oh no, we got to talk in the subway. It's like, no, go. And then Lawrence Fishburne goes, and then it's like, Carrie Ann Moss is like, now is this time that I want to tell you all about the Oracle told me. And it's like, no, this is not the time. This is not the time. Get out. This is like that moment in a horror movie where you're just like, the person is going to stab you. It's right behind you. Just get out of the building. But she doesn't want to. She wants to tell him like, oh, it's, you know, it's just really important, blah, 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 blah. And it's just dragging on forever. But the weirdness of Lawrence Fishburne apparently getting sucked out of there was something that the homeless man inside of the subway tunnel had witnessed and seemed to have alarmed him.
And threw a flag in the system.
Yeah, and somehow the act of being alarmed by that notifies Agent Smith with his earpiece, so he turns on the rooftop, and then he takes possession of the homeless man who's on the ground, and gets up just in time to shoot the phone as Carrie Ann Moss dematerializes, and that breaks the phone, so Neo can't follow. And then there's a big fight.
Too. Pretty cool plan.
Yeah. And then that leaves just Neo and Smith to fight. And there's a big fight. Big wire work, stunt work.
Oh, right. There's another one of the bullet time shots here where they're like flying in the air and grabbing each other's wrists and trying to shoot each other in the head.
Yes. And it's sort of like from above, and the guns all have like the ripply sound wave stuff going through the air.
That's another. Oh my God, I don't know about you, but after this movie came out, I don't know how many tutorials I watched about like how to create the ripply bullet time trails behind fake bullets and I don't know, combustion or something.
Well, the movie's biggest impact was on the screensaver market, that's for sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I had that screensaver too, but like there were so many tutorials about like how to use what do you call it? Particle emitters to make the little wobbly circles that then emit and trail and stuff. It was so dumb. That's one of the least attractive effects in the whole movie.
Yeah, and it was just not, no one doesn't do much for me. But so they have a big fight, big fight. And then Neo gets out of the fight and he goes running. And this is an interesting chase scene because while he's being chased, the people that he's running past are turning into agents. And most of them, they cleverly did off camera.
Yeah, like the guy holding the bag of groceries and then like moves it out of his face and he's suddenly the agent guy.
Yeah, and the old lady who's like, I don't know, chopping onions or something, and then there's a knife that goes into the wall and he turns back and it's not an old lady, it's an agent. There's just a lot of interesting shots where they had planned it out so that they could cut around having to do the morphing effect.
Yeah, it's cool. It's the reveal of the thing Morpheus said earlier where it's like potentially all of these people are agents, so keep a sharp eye, amigo.
Yeah, and it works really well. I mean, we don't... this movie never explains the mechanics of how that possession works. If, like, they can just, like, browse other people's brains and see if they're, like, alarmed by something and then just take them over.
I assume they're plugged into all of the people's inputs, so everyone's connected to a database and they got their little earpiece so they can hear the database. Which is why he doesn't hear the update about the lobby when he unplugs. But yeah, they are all seeing and all knowing.
Yeah, but then none of them go down to the lobby when the lobby scene is occurring. And none of them are there to apprehend Morpheus and Neo or Trinity while they're walking around in just broad daylight. Because presumably they haven't alarmed anybody. And that's my guess as to like whether or not they're, if someone is concerned, if that is
there are too many potential
matches
out there that the input is clouded in the database.
Yeah, they can't possibly be looking through everyone's eyes. Is what I'm saying. Like this isn't like the Eye of Sauron or something like that. Like they can't see everything. There must be some sort of limit on it because otherwise they'd just be showing up everywhere in the movie. But seemingly, the limit is relaxed for this chase scene because they can just pop up. Right after him, everywhere.
Well, I think it's kind of like they know which direction he's running and when he turns a corner, and they're just like jumping ahead like half a block every time.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense too, because they get an understanding of what path he might be taking to a hard line. And
is there like a map of like where all the hard lines in the city are? Like, wouldn't you just know where those are and then just like stage one agent at all of them anytime somebody was in the Matrix?
I would assume so, but there is a weird line that Tank says, like, we have an old patch on a hard line over here. So I don't know if that means like there's just some sort of selective process where they can sort of tap these things to function in this way.
It's like one of those, it's like Swordfish. You got to find a bank that's on the backbone of the network or something.
It doesn't make, I mean,
cause that's how networks work.
It's not how networks work. But so they go to he finally gets to the thing, but right before he can get inside the room, he's shot by Agent Smith in the chest twice. And there's
shot
blood
like
on the
nine
wall.
Nine times with a gun that only holds like six bullets.
It doesn't matter. More importantly, there's blood on the wall behind him before he hits the wall, because obviously they shot a scene of him hitting the wall earlier than that, but then they didn't wipe down the wall.
Well, also, the bullet could have gone through. It's a very, very large caliber weapon.
No, but it's the back blood. You can tell from the scene when he actually goes up against it and then has a back blood smear.
Are you saying it
doesn't
look like splatter?
No, it doesn't look like splatter. It looks like a big blood mark. Like I think it's a continuity issue, but it doesn't matter.
You know what they could use to fix that is visual effects.
Yeah.
I hear that's useful for fixing things.
He goes sliding down the thing onto the ground and he's dead. And meanwhile, the Sentinels have found the Nebuchadnezzar, and they're all after them and their biz, and they can't fire the EMP because it might kill Neo, but now that he's dead, should they fire the EMP? But they're still not doing it yet for some reason. And then Carrie Ann Moss is...
And then, yeah, Trinity decides to tell the slowest story in the history of stories while they're about to be murdered.
Yeah, there's, like, literally a red laser, like, blasting through the room behind her and like, arc welding sparks.
Like, you jump to the end of this? Like... The oracle told me a thing, and that thing was about me, and that me was about in love, and that love was about... Like, put it all together into one sentence.
What's really kind of frustrating about this is that Trinity starts the movie as such a smart, capable character who could be the star of the film in her own right. But at the end of the film, her biggest contribution is that she says, the Oracle told me that I would fall in love with the One. So her grand scheme in all of this is relegated to superhero's girlfriend. And
I don't know. I think she's still a pretty capable member of the team. But yeah, I mean, even in the opening little computer screen, whatcha who's it thing, Cypher is accusing her like, oh, you really like this guy, don't you? Because you keep watching him, because she says like, I'm here to take over your shift. And he's like, why are you taking over my shift? You just like watching this guy, don't you? So like, clearly there's like an attraction from the beginning. And all right, maybe she just really likes his hacking skills or whatever.
But
really like the way you use that pearl.
It just seems like if somebody's going to have a fate, it shouldn't be you're fated to fall in love with somebody who's going to save the world. It's like there has to be something about them, like maybe like they have to have some sort of self-worth or contribution to the universe other than happening to fall in love with the person who's going to save the world.
Yeah, that's why I mean, I think they try to do a little bit of that stuff in the beginning where they have their mutual respect as hackers who like each other or something. I don't know.
Mm. Yeah, but it kind of reminds me of the Lego movie.
Does it?
I think they mirrored that for the Lego movie. Because, like, Elizabeth Banks is, like, you know, she's the master builder. And she's, like, building all this stuff and doing all this stuff. And then it's, like, Chris Pratt's just some dumbfounded person. But it turns out he's really the one who's going to save everyone. Like, literally, I think they call him the one. But then he's special. And he's going to be the master builder who's going to, like, master build more than everybody else. And then she gets relegated to just being Chris Pratt's girlfriend. And
well, she's
also
Batman's girlfriend, and also the Lego movie does have the advantage of saying that there's the prophecy is made up and the special is not actually special. Spoilers for the Lego movie. Sorry, people. Mm,
yeah. Well, but anyway, it happens a lot of times in other movies too, where it's somebody who, a woman who is depicted as being like so well qualified and skilled and having put in the time and the effort, is supplanted by some novice they find who's like, oh, I don't know if I'm really actually talented or anything. Oh, I guess I am. And then he saves the day. So I feel like there's an odd male fantasy that goes on in these sorts of stories that is just weird.
I think they do a better job of that in the sequels of this movie, where they put them as equals. And there are numerous instances where they both sort of like save the day for each other in different ways. Obviously, Neo does it in a really creepy, weird way when he like reaches into the Matrix and pulls a bullet out of her Matrix code or whatever, but like where she goes in and defies him and blows up the thing to save everybody or whatever. And then, you know, there's the whole love story, the whole like the people need you, but I need you and blah, all that stuff. Anyway,
we'll get to that. But anyway, she gives her love spiel about how he can't die because she was supposed to fall in love with the One, and she's in love with him. And sparks,
and
kiss.
I think this movie works and the pacing and everything works, but I do always take a moment to step back when things like this happen and go, how long has Neo been on this ship? A week and a half? 2 weeks?
And she's been watching him for a long time.
Yeah, you've been
maybe
watching him for a long time, yeah. So you guys could fast forward to the third act of your romance, right?
Yeah, it's apparently. She reveals her love for him, kisses him, and this resuscitates him inside of the Matrix. And she says, "Get up!" And then he gets up. And
this reminded me of one of my other favorite shots of this movie is when Smith shoots the phone after Trinity goes through, and then they have their fight, and Neo's getting beat up, and he spits blood, and they do the cut where you could see spits blood on both sides. And
how does that work?
Well, no. The part that makes me laugh every time is she goes, oh, he's killing him or whatever, and she, like, tears some cloth, like, off of her sleeve, and it's like, what are you doing? You, like, just to wipe the blood off of his, like, mouth? Like, just go get a rag. Like, you don't have to just like you have to dramatically tear something off of your sleeve. Your clothes are already tattered. Are all of their clothes so tattered because every time somebody gets beat up in the Matrix, they like tear a bit off and like wipe the blood off their mouth or something?
They're just walking bandages. The whole mechanic of like you get beat up or shot or whatever in the Matrix, because if you get shot in the Matrix, you don't get a bullet hole, but your heart stops. But if you get like hit really hard in the mouth in the Matrix, like blood spews out of your mouth.
Not only you spit as if you were like literally punched in the gut.
How do the physical mechanics of that work?
It's probably just, you know, dumbed down for us audiences because we have to see that for it to make sense for us. Because yeah, if they were just like laying there and they get shot in the Matrix, then all of a sudden they just like flatline and be like, well, that's slightly anticlimactic.
I suppose, but at least I wouldn't be questioning where blood was like spewing out of somebody. But so she kisses and gets up, and then he goes walking back in the hallway, and then all the agents are like, what? And they shoot him. And then we get more of those things that you like as the bullets stop in midair.
Mm-hmm. And in this particular shot, we're riding along with the bullets, and then the camera like slowly moves into the circular wake of one of the bullets, like inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very nice.
And then Neo reaches out and grabs one of the bullets. The others stop, and he looks at it as if he's never seen a bullet before, and he drops it on the ground. And then all the other ones fall on the ground. And the agent's like, what? And Smith runs over, and Neo jumps inside of Smith, and then there's a bunch of...
Don't forget he takes the time to do his, like, one-handed blocks of Smith.
Oh, yeah.
It's
bro,
we're on an abbreviated timetable here, and Trinity's super slow I love you story used up a lot of that time, so can you not, like, just play with the agent? Can you just, like, get on with it?
Yeah, he went to his next Dragon Ball Z level, and so he's...
Super Saiyan, Neo.
Yeah, because this is one of those silly things about the Matrix where it's just like, oh, you haven't seen my final form. It's like, oh, God, stop it. But
let me guess, your final form is wearing some black clothes with a leather jacket and sunglasses.
Some Maui Jim sunglasses. But so he's getting he's deflecting the punches very easily and handily, one-handed to demonstrate how skilled he is. Meanwhile, everybody else is getting chewed up in the real world, but whatever. And then he jumps inside of Agent Smith's torso. He explodes after a bunch of normals crawling through him and stuff, distorting the image of him. And then kablooey, green fragments and stuff. And then the other two agents look at each other and then run in opposite directions.
I like the way when he flexed the hallway walls, like, stretch out and then, like, wobble back into place.
That's interesting because it lets you know that the code is adjusting for the non- things that should have been happening.
He is one with the code.
Yeah, because he can see the Matrix. he can see the Matrix because all the hallways have the green screensaver stuff all over them, and the agents standing around have the green screensaver stuff over them. But he gets back to the real world just in time for them to do the EMP pulse, and they get rid of all the sentinels. They all clatter to the hull or whatever. Day is saved. Now we cut back to the same tracing program we saw at the beginning of the film, and we get a call, and it's Keanu Reeves, and he's addressing some nameless entity, which appears to be the Matrix itself, I guess? The entirety of computerdom? I'm not sure.
Mr. The Matrix. He pulled up the yellow pages and called Mr. Matrix.
Yeah, so he's given a ring to the Matrix's boss, to the general manager. He's leaving a voicemail, and the search program stops. System failure. I don't know why, but it's very dramatic. And then it pulls through to reveal the inside of the mouthpiece of the public telephone. And then we pull out. We got Neo there, and he's chit chatting about how, you know, there's, you know, it's up to you how this is gonna go, you know, because I'm gonna free everybody and everything's gonna be great now. And then he Supermans out of there. And then we get the Rage Against the Machine. And then that leads you to believe in the next movie that he's just going to be flying around destroying everything. And this is wrong. That's not what's going to happen.
He flies around a bit in the other movies.
Yeah, not like this, though. His power level takes a dip at the beginning of the next one, because I think they realized, you know, maybe he's a little too strong at the end of this
one. What about the part where he says he's doing a Superman thing again when he flies like all the way around the world to catch Carrie Ann Moss if she's fallen from the buildings?
Yeah, but remember how he's dispatching agents so handily here? And then in the next movie, he's like barely struggling to fight one?
Yeah, because there's upgrades. It's like, remember, there's upgrades. They have different buffer guys.
But it doesn't...
I agree. If he can see the Matrix and he can control the Matrix easily. It doesn't matter what kind of program is there.
Does not compute. But whatever.
He would just be like, force quit, agent, and then they would all just disappear.
But I think that about wraps it up for us on The Matrix. Mm-hmm. Do you have anything else you want to say?
Still a really good movie. If you can like try and take all of the bad parodies and bad references and bad sequels to this movie and put them out of your mind for 2 hours and 16 minutes and try and watch this movie like we would have watched it for the first time in 1999. This is actually a pretty great movie still.
Yeah. It's on Netflix right now, for the time being. So go get on that, peeps.
Yeah, scope it out. It's got a good soundtrack.
Yeah. I mean, they're not all winners. But no. And then you can also get the Don Davis's French horn stuck in your head. Horny Davis.
Yeah. And the color green.
Oh, so much green. It's not easy being green. But
super green.